You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 190. Follow your dreams, believe in yourself, and don't give up. Anonymous.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Well, guys, today on the show, we have a self-made filmmaker who has done some pretty remarkable stuff in his career. We have Andy Irwin, one half of the Irwin brothers, who are very well known in the industry for making films like October Baby, Woodlawn, I Can Only Imagine, and the new hit film American Underdog, The Kurt Warner Story. Now, Andy and I sat down and had a fantastic conversation about how he got his start, how nobody believed in the kind of stories him and his brother were trying to tell, and how they took things into their own hands and made a good amount of cash and revenue off of their films, to say the least. I Can Only Imagine pulled in about $80 million on a, let's just say, smaller budget than that. So they've done very, very well for themselves. And it is a very inspiring story, and I hope it will inspire you guys to keep going and to follow your dreams of being a filmmaker or a screenwriter, or just follow whatever creative dream you have. So without any further ado, please enjoy my inspiring conversation with Andy Irwin. I'd like to welcome the show, Andy Irwin. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm great, man. It's good to be with you, and good to talk movies.
Yeah, man, absolutely, brother. So, man, you've had a very interesting career, to say the least, bro. How did you get started in this insanity that we call the film industry?
I mean, I think anybody that gets involved, either they pay a lot for film school or they run away and join the circus. And we were kind of more the circus kind of performer route. And so, my brother and I, we were kind of studio rats. My dad was in news growing up. He was the news anchor at Channel 11 in Dallas and the CBS affiliate there. And so we always grew up around kind of the industry. And, when we kind of became teenagers, they let us use the equipment from midnight till 4 a.m. if we worked off the books for $10 a day. And so it wasn't at the CBS affiliate. I won't name no one because they broke a lot of child labor laws. But we did that when I was 15, my brother's 12. And we just kind of fell in love with telling stories. And so I went off to college in New York, and John was in high school, and I just heard what he was doing back home. I was like, that's way cooler what I'm doing. So I dropped out of school, and we started working on the weekends for sports networks like ESPN as cameramen. And that paid the bills for us to the other 5 days of the week to be able to have this hobby grown out of control. So at that point, we lived in Birmingham, Alabama, started a little production company, ended up working in the documentaries and music videos, and with this idea of one day doing features. But it took about 15 years till we got to our first one. And it was a crazy journey to get there.
Very cool, man. And so you were hustling as a camera guy, trying to get their movies made, and you got your first micro budget film made, which was October Baby, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, it was a small budget film. We did it for about $750,000, 19-day shoot. At that point we were doing a lot of music videos, and so doing a lot of rock videos, we were kind of got good at blowing things up. And so, you know, if we couldn't figure out how to end a music video, we'd just blow something up. And in fact, the last treatment we did for a band called Skillet, it said, band comes out, things blow up. It starts to rain, more things blow up. It stops raining, everything blows up. And that was the whole treatment. And that video kind of blew up. And so, we ended up directing more and more second unit kind of things. And getting on film sets, doing stunt sequences was kind of our thing. And then, you know, we just said, it's now or never. We need to kind of take the opportunity to try to do, see what we could do on our own. And so we just said, rather than lean into all of our tricks of anything flashy, let's just do a small little character drama. Mm. And there was a friend of ours named Gianna Jessen that had an incredible story about her life story. That we had heard, and we just said, what if we fictionalized that and kind of put it in the context of this kind of romantic kind of coming of age story, and did it at a little $750,000 micro budget. Should have never worked. If we had known what we know now, I mean, like, we would have told ourselves never to go for it. But we raised the money to both put it out in theaters and do it ourselves, and it made enough money to give us a chance to do more. So it was that was our journey.
Now that the ignorance is bliss, isn't it? When you're young.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, they say whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, but there's certain things in this industry that actually kill you. And, I think if you knew all that going in, like, we would never, I mean, I talk to my kids all the time. I'm just like, I look at like just the recklessness of a 13-year-old and I'm like, man, if I had known now what I know as a dad, there was no way I would have done some of the stuff as a kid. Because you just, like, that could actually kill you. But, you know, when you're young and ignorant of those things, you just say, hey, why not do it like this? And I think as a filmmaker, you know, it's better to try that stuff out early. And I think you're a little bit more reckless. And sometimes it works and sometimes you die.
Yeah. Exactly. Hopefully figuratively, not literally, in our business. Now, but with October Baby, you actually took it out on your own, and you actually did your own four-walling it of it and getting it out in the world. Or how did you actually get it? Because it was a fairly big hit for such a small budget.
Yeah, I mean, for such a small budget, we felt like we really needed to be disciplined to do something that was just about kind of character relationships. And we had done this tiny little pilot for a small TV network that didn't make it. We did a little pilot with this small cast that we fell in love with. And in fact, one of the cast members that we discovered was James Austin Johnson, who is now the new Biden and Trump on Saturday Night Live.
Okay.
And he was in Nashville, and he's since broken out this year. But he was this funny little kid that was 19 years old here in Nashville. And so we took that cast, and the pilot didn't get picked up, but we were like, we love this cast. Let's insert them into this story that we're writing. And so we wrote it around that cast. And when we got done with it, it wasn't meant to be kind of a controversial film at all. It was really just based on my friend Gianna's story. But it hit some kind of, you know, raw nerves with different people. And there's a lot of distributors that were nervous to kind of take it out. And we just had that, we had that independent film spirit that we're just like, well, why not take it out on our own?
Again,
and
the, again, the ignorance is helpful.
Ignorance. And then, and then we went and raised the money to put it in theaters and hired, you know, Samuel Goldwyn to put it out. And it really should have been a train wreck, and it worked. And, and, you know, I think the goal with any, you know, independent filmmaker, especially early on, is for your product to do well enough to find an audience, you know, that's that, that at least validates enough to allow other people to take a risk on you to let you do another one. And, you know, so we weren't aiming for a home run. We were really aiming to let's get on base and let's do a story that we believe in. It's a story that we're proud of, but, you know, but it's not anything that's going to shatter records. But let's get on base, show that we can do this, have one under our belt, and let's keep going forward. And that was what October Baby was for us.
Now, with your music video background, what did you bring from your music video background into the into your narrative feature film? Because, I mean, I've directed music videos a ton, and there's a lot of – you get a lot of hours on set, which I think helps a lot. And you deal with – well, you deal with craziness that you would never deal with on a feature film set, sometimes on music video sets.
Yeah. I mean – oh my gosh. I mean, I think there's a lot of things. I think first of all, it's kind of like, you know, short films with a lot more volume to it because you're working on somebody else's budget. You know, you're not having to go out and raise, you know, $20,000 a pop to do short films. You're somebody's paying you to do it. And, you know, and back then there was actually budget for music videos. They've since kind of, you know, gone to where, you know, you can't do it unless, you know, you're a college kid. But back then they actually had budgets. And I think there were several things. It allowed us to kind of get just time in the saddle and to try different things. And I think just like any other art form, you know, for a long time up front, you make your way imitating other people, just trying stuff on until finally there comes that moment where you find your voice and you're like, oh, this is the kind of stories I tell. This is my style. But for a long time up front, you're just trying different things on. Be like, what if it was like this? What if it was like that? And doing music videos allowed us to kind of try a lot of hats on. And so we started out in more the Christian contemporary world. And, you know, I had a lot of fun there. But then, you know, moved into country some. And then we ended up doing a lot of stuff in the rock world. That was where we just got to experiment. And then the second thing was, is allowed us to learn how to deal with big personalities. And I think there's, you know, I think every actor wants to sing and every singer wants to act. So they're, you know, intrinsically kind of the same species. And I think it just learned to deal with, you know, fragile egos, deal with people that need to feel safe. No artist, whether it's a music artist or an actor, wants to look stupid. And I think typically a lot of the neurotic behavior that is exhibited is just from people being afraid of looking stupid. And so it just allowed us to learn how to navigate a lot of that stuff. So it knocked some years off of those headaches of learning how to speak that language. So that when we stepped onto a film set, it's just like, oh, okay, this personality is familiar at least. And then my brother more particularly than me is more visual. And he brought a lot of that visual style into how we shoot.
Yeah, I mean, I think as directors, the thing I've talked to actors all the time is they just want to feel safe. And if you can make them feel safe, they'll give you the best they can. But if they don't feel safe, that's when the problems occur.
Yeah, I've worked with a lot of actors that, you know, there's certain actors I work with that have a reputation for sideways energy. A lot of them are like, no, they're sweethearts as long as they feel safe. That sideways energy means either you had a toxic film set or a weak film director or somebody that didn't really know what they wanted. And they felt like they had to. It's the same thing that happens with kids when, like, you know, my kids at home, if there's not like some boundaries and stuff and they feel like they're in charge, you know, and they don't feel safe, then that's where you get all the sideways energy. But if they really know where they fit in the family and you're giving them really good boundaries and giving them enough leash to be their own people and not trying to control them, but you're trying to direct them. And it's imperfect science, but it's really about that safety. And that's what creates that with actors. And I think we started learning that with a lot of the crazy neurosis that happens on music video set.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Oh, music videos. They are wonderful, aren't they?
Yeah, right.
If there was a podcast, we could just tell stories of what happened on set that we could legally say publicly.
Yeah, I would have to change all the names. There was one music video I did where there's two artists that I won't name.
Sure.
That might have both been men, but the label paired this group together, and they were a duo. They're a famous duo. But they didn't get along. And so because they weren't like best buds the way they appeared on screen. They were like two different artists that were solo artists. They paired together. And so, you know, they had their own tour bus, each had their own tour bus. And it was a hot summer day and we're doing this music video. And I would go into one's tour bus and say, so-and-so's, you know, we're ready to get on set. He's like, well, is so-and-so my partner? Is he ready to go? No. He's like, well, I'm not going out until he does. I'm like, I'll be right back. And I go into their tour bus and I'd be like, hey man. And I, this went back and forth for like 30 minutes until I taught one of them into coming out first. And so it was constant. It was crazy.
And I'm sure that's probably one of the most tame stories you have.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the one that I legally not, I'm not afraid of getting sued for that one. So we're good.
Now, you know, as directors, man, there's always that one day on set that the whole world's coming crashing down around you. The camera's not working, you're losing your light, the actor won't come out of the trailer, all this kind of stuff. What was that worst day for you? Which there's an argument to be made that every day has one of those, but what was the one that sticks out in your mind and how did you get over it? How did you get through that process that day?
I think as a director, you know, you always, I mean, the first two or three days of filming any film, the first 2 days of principal photography, you're questioning all your life choices. And you're like, it's all burning down. This is where I get exposed. This is where they find out that I don't know what I'm doing. Right. You know, and it just, and you develop kind of a little bit of that marathoner's pace and you get into a rhythm. And I think the biggest thing you have to learn as a film director is that you got to let certain fires burn. You know, that, you know, you're not going to be able to put out every fire every day. You just got to get, you got to keep one from consuming the entire set. And so there's little fires that are always burning. You got to get used to, there's at any point in the day, there's at least five people that are going to be pissed at you. And I think as you have more time in the saddle, you get a little bit more calluses where you're like, you don't lack empathy. You're not immune to the fact that it's hard, but you just have to be okay that people aren't okay with you sometimes. And, but for me, the biggest catastrophe that ended up, I think, actually making a better film was on the movie Woodlawn, you know. And so Woodlawn was another independent film that we had done. So it was one that was the most personal to us. It was it was a story that my dad used to tell us as a bedtime story growing up in Birmingham, Alabama. And it was the one that we wanted to make. And it's a true story about the last part of integration in Birmingham, Alabama in the 70s. And this one little football team that was the last to integrate and the first black superstar that came out of that system, this kid, Tony Nathan. And so we had raised the money to do it. It was the most money we had raised at that point. It was about $13 million.
Wow.
We went out to start, you know, it was the last week of pre-production. And I cast a kid out of London to play the role of Tony. I don't know what it is about British actors, but they play the best people from the South. You look at anybody on TV right now that's got a Southern accent, I guarantee you they're from England. But I cast this kid, really good actor that's going on to do some big things. And the week before we started filming, for whatever reason, that was not an explanation, the embassy in pulled his visa. Oh. They wouldn't let him travel. And we're like, you know, we didn't have the budget to push. So, you know, instantly, I was like panicked. I just said, and our casting director starts, you know, just throwing out all sorts of names of people that were good actors, but I'm like, well, are they athletic? Do they play football? You know, because it was so important that this actor be able to do a lot of in-camera stuff. And so we were panicked. There was this one kid named Caleb Castile that was the stunt double for Tony. And Caleb had auditioned for Tony. I hadn't seen his audition. It wasn't particularly good, but he just had this charisma that wouldn't quit. And he said, well, if I don't get Tony, I'm going to be the stunt double. So he shows up as stunt double. And this kid played for Nick Saban at the University of Alabama. And he runs like a gazelle, man. He just is pretty to watch. Mm-hmm. And I was just, you know, I'm kind of a person of prayer. And I was just like, man, what do I do? And I just, Caleb's name popped in my head. And I was like, surely not him. He's been in one TV commercial. And I
like that. Surely not him. As you're talking to the voice in your head, surely not him.
Surely not him. And just, it felt right. And he just had this spirit that wouldn't quit. So I called him up and I just said, Caleb, I need you to get over here to the studio. I'm going to give you every opportunity to win this role today. And he said, I've been waiting on the call. I signed my side the day I auditioned with the date and said, this is the day I got the role. And he said, I just knew it was mine. And I was like, holy cow. So I threw him in a room with John Voight, who was playing Bear Bryant. And Caleb just, you know, and good acting is about how you respond. It's about being in the moment, being present. And it's not about acting, it's about reacting. And Caleb just reacted incredible being in the room with an Oscar winner. And he had the skill. And the whole movie, we called this the whole team together said, you know, this movie is about rallying around this kid, Tony, and the team rallying around him. We're going to rally around Caleb. He's our guy. And so he became the star. He became number one on the call sheet that day. And it made the movie. And since then, Caleb's broken out. He's on one of the leads on NCIS Los Angeles now and is doing incredible for himself. But that was the day he went from being a stunt guy to being number one on the call sheet. And I think a lot of times on a film set, the worst moment where you feel like it's all going down, mm-hmm. it doesn't always work out. But a lot of times there's a doorway there to make something better.
Yeah, you always plan. You always may have a plan, but it generally rarely ever goes according to plan. And it generally, I'm going to say 9 out of 10 times, it ends up better than what you expected.
Yep. It usually does. I mean, and I think that's the hardest thing for young filmmakers. I think it was a big lesson for me there. But for young filmmakers, and that was my third feature at that point. But for young filmmakers, there's this fear of if I let go of control, that that people are going to see that I really, mm-hmm. That I'm a fraud. And I think any artist feels that. And I think as a result, we hold it tighter to the vest. Be like, I don't want you to judge me. Don't judge my ugly baby. And I think what I've learned is when I do that, when I have done that, the best I can hope that for that movie to turn out is the one that I have in my head. There's no room for discovery. But when you kind of loosen your grip and you trust the close group of collaborators to speak into that process and have this policy of best idea wins, mm-hmm. then there's this element of discovery where it doesn't matter where the idea comes from. If it's a great idea, let's use it. And it when you realize that you have control because you're in the chair, you are the director, there's a lot of power that goes with that allows you to look at other people's ideas. So you discover things that you wouldn't have other ways. So it makes a better movie.
You know, I always find it fascinating. I've been blessed by speaking to so many amazing high-end performing people in this business, Oscar winners, Emmy winners, and so on. And it sure. never ceases to amaze me the whole concept of imposter syndrome. It yeah. is something that is so prevalent in, I mean, I'm like, I talk to somebody, I'm like, man, you won an Oscar. It's like, yeah, but I get sick when I go on set for the first day. I'm like,
yeah,
wow. And it's, so I always like to let independent filmmakers know it's okay. Even the top of the top legends
yeah.
have issues with imposter yep. syndrome. It's not something that's just you. Everyone's got it.
Well, I remember hearing Joe Wright talk about the first day
yeah.
On set with Gary Oldman on Darkest Hour. And he's like, I thought my job was supposed to be just making the environment around Gary right so that he can you know, do his thing. And it gets in the first take, and Gary leans over and is like, you know, what do you think? Was it too far? And he said, Joe realized at that moment, he said, really great directors want to be directed. I mean, great, really great actors want to be directed. And, you know, that idea that any, you know, anybody always has that feeling of, I don't really know if I'm doing it right. And so after directing Hoyt in Woodlawn, I loved him in it, but he called me, late one night, and John was like, Andy, it's Voight. Am I any good in this picture? I'm like, you're great. He's like, if I'm no good, just cut me out. Just cut the character completely out. I was like, John, go ask your Oscar, bro.
You know,
I directed Cloris Leachman. She had an Oscar. And then in this latest one, Anna Paquin, she's the youngest Oscar winner. It never goes away. It just, all of us feel like, how did we stumble into this job? You know, and there's a fraction of a percent of people that are just so qualified, they can do whatever they want. And there's an arrogance that goes with that. But I think even in that case, I think it's motivated by insecurity. You know, I had a great interaction with Denzel Washington when I was mixing Underdog, and we were on the sound stages at Sony, and he was mixing Letters to Jordan next door. I had Underdog. Michael Mann was mixing his TV series he's doing right now across the hallway, and then Jason Reitman was test screening Ghostbusters on the fourth stage. So we're all on stage six. And I texted somebody, and I said, oh my gosh, how did I get on this stage? Who's the imposter here? And my filmmaker friend wrote back and said, all four of you. I was like, oh, okay. All right.
I'm sure Denzel at one point or another said that the same thing about, like, because he just, like, everyone starts somewhere, man. No one just comes out an Oscar winner. No one just comes out knowing everything. You got to go through the process. You got to get the bumps. I always call you got to get the shrapnel. That shrapnel is what makes you, man. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Now, I mean, I got to touch on I Can Only Imagine, man. I recently, after I watched American Underdog, which we're going to talk about in a second, I went back. Like, let me go watch that, because I'd seen the trailers. I'd never seen it. Man, that movie was impactful, man. It was such a power. It was such a powerfully emotional film, and it's such an oddity, because it's like, hey, let's make a movie about how a song was written. Now, it is one of the biggest songs of all time, but it's like, you don't hear that. Like, let's go see how My Heart, What Goes On was written. Like, it's nothing. Right. So how did you even that would be an interesting, I've seen the making of that movie.
Yeah.
No, but how did you get that? How did you get involved with that? How did you want to tell that story?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was funny, because, you know, we do peddle in true stories, and we do very much gravitate towards stories of faith. I think that's become much more a mainstream experience over the past 10 years than maybe when we first started. Mm-hmm. It was much more a tiny little niche kind of early on, but now it's kind of found its footing, where, you know, the same way that other niche genres like, you know, superhero movies or horror films have found their footing in something that's more mainstream. You know, but when we started, we were trying to find that. Hopefully we've been part of that solution, you know, as well as others like Devon Franklin. But with I Can Only Imagine, you know, we're not smart enough to really go out and find great stories. They just typically land in our lap. And I was screening, we did a comedy. I do not recommend directing a comedy. It is very tough. but we did a small comedy. Our second film was a small comedy for Sony called Mom Side Out, and it was definitely you know, took years off my life, but in the middle of that, I was test screening the comedy up here in Nashville, and I just was cold calling a lot of people in the community that might be interested in watching it. And so I reached out to Bart Millard from the band Mercy Me, who wrote the song I Can Only Imagine. I wrote him on Facebook, and I just said, hey, we don't know each other, but we run in the same circles. I'm test screening my film tonight. Would love for you to see it. You want to, you know, come see it? He said, wrote back right away. Said, I just moved here from Texas. Yeah, I would love to see it. And at the end of the film, he really enjoyed it. And he said, can we talk? And he said, there's a movie studio that's been developing my life story, the story of my song, for the past 5 years. I would love you guys to take a look at it.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And I said, well, it's kind of serendipitous. They sent us the script this morning.
Oh,
and wow. And it just was kind of one of those things. And then I was like, what are you doing tonight? And he's like, well, what are you doing? I was like, I was going to go watch Captain America at midnight. He's like, I was going to do the same thing. I was like, then we just become best friends. But, but you know, the whole stepbrothers thing. But I read this. We read a little bit of the script, and the script just didn't jive with me because it was just that. It was about somebody's life experience, and it ended on a downer note. And this said, you know, one day Mark wrote a great song, and it was like, we're like, this isn't a movie. It has to be something universally relatable, and it has to be something that's beyond just the song. And we sat down with Bart one day, and my brother asked him, Bart, if I were to say, kind of hold a gun to your head and say, is there a God, what would you say? And he said, absolutely, because of the change I saw in my father. He went from being the most abusive man I know to being my best friend. And if something can change his life, it can change anybody. We're like, well, that's interesting. And then I was doing an interview about a year later when we were promoting Woodlawn. And the host asked me off the air, he's like, what story are you looking at next? And I said, well, off the record, we're looking at the story of I Can Only Imagine. And he said, oh my gosh. He's like, I was at the Ryman that night when Amy Grant pulled him up on stage and gave him his song back. That's the most magic thing I've ever seen in music. And I was like, wait, I don't know about this. So I called up Martin. I'm like, did this happen? He's like, oh yeah, man. That was the most magic night of my life. I forgot to tell you guys that. And I'm like, you idiot.
Help me help you.
help you. I'm like, well, that's a movie. And I'm like, there's your triumph. And so we engineered that whole film from the standpoint of what would it be. I think there's something universally relatable about the kind of the father wound that a lot of guys have in particular, you know, people in particular, but guys. And that desire of every man, because of that fraud, imposter syndrome, wanting to have their father stand and applaud them. Oof. And so we were like, what if we engineered the moment at the end that there's an empty room and he sees his father, and the whole movie builds to that moment. And, you know, and then, you know, this abusive father that eventually stands in approval. And for men in particular, when they watch the film, it catches them way off guard and brings really big emotion. Because of that. And it's beyond something of faith. I mean, faith is definitely a huge part of the story, but it's really about that universal desire of redemption between a father and a son. And I think Dennis Quaid killed it. I think it's one of his best performances as the father. And I'm really, really proud. I'm really proud of how the film turned out. And that was really the launching point. We had a big disagreement with the studio on how to make it. They said there was only 17,000 people on the planet that would watch it because it was just a.
To be fair, on paper, not a good song.
Yeah, it's very. No, not at all. Not at all. It's a song about a Christian. Yeah, it's a movie about a Christian song. Like, really? In fact, the day that we started making it, there was a big Deadline article that said the music biopic is dead. And that was the same year that Star is Born and Bohemian Rhapsody and a bunch of others came out. So, you know, I guess the article was wrong, but you know, I think we had a big disagreement, and so we went out and again raised the money to both make and release it. We did a blended fund of both P&A and the production budget, which was the production budget was about $7 million on it, and then we bought it out from under the studio and made it independently, and then right when we started shopping it, Roadside Attractions came along and said, we know how to put this out because we specialize in kind of awards films that are niche. And they had just done Manchester by Sea, and that was their big, you know, hit. And we were like, okay, we'll trust you with it if we can do this deal with your sister company, Lionsgate, too. And so Lionsgate stepped on board. We did a deal with them and rented the system and put it out. And then little $7 million film did $86 million. Just a good breakout moment.
Not a bad. So that turned out of it. It started at a studio. Studio didn't believe in it the way you guys believed in it. You took it back from the studio, put your own money, found your own money in, and released it yourself, and then, of course, got all the money out of it.
Well, our investors did really well.
Yeah, of course.
Hey, we didn't do too bad either. I mean, my kids are going to college, but it definitely was life changing for us as well.
We did a
page one rewrite, you know, our version of the story. And that's when the studio, who had worked 5 years on it and couldn't crack the story, didn't like that. And we just said, hey, we're going to stick with our vision. And we made, you know, you don't always want to go all in the moment, but there's certain hands where you're like, this is my all in moment. And so we pushed out all the chips in the middle of the table, and it was either going to be a success or a disaster. And we just happened to land on the front side of that.
Yeah, it landed on black for you. And yeah, there's no question, but look, there are those moments in life where you're given a choice. You're like, are you in or are you out? And unfortunately, so many filmmakers make that they do that all in at the very beginning of their career, and they like mortgage their house and they want to tell this story and it doesn't work out well for them. So your story is definitely an anomaly. But then for everyone listening, well, they did it. I'm like, yeah, they did it. But look at the story they had. They had a song that millions upon tens of millions of people around the world knew. You had an audience. That's what the studio didn't understand. They didn't understand that there was so much love for that story. But then again, it wasn't just about the song. It's really about a son and a father.
Well, it's about the ingredient. Like, you know, that's why you can't go all in on every hand. You know, the ego artist in each person that says, oh, this is going to be, you know, that's only one component. The bigger things are branded IP is king. You know, having something that has a following. Mm-hmm. Then secondly, some that has the story ingredients. You know, for us, we very much look at kind of how what Jordan Peele did with Get Out. I mean, he had a great horror movie. It appealed to his core fans, but he had this rare universal overlay to it that appealed beyond just slasher movies. It had a social justice appeal. It had a Hitchcock feel. It was something for everyone. Or, you know, or a movie like Quiet Place that did that same thing. It was about that universal idea of a father trying to make his family safe, a father and mother trying to fight for their family. That was beyond a horror movie. And so those ingredients are rare. But when you have the ingredients, you have the branded IP. And then the third thing is timing. It's all about timing. Like, I can only imagine could have happened 10 other ways at 10 other times. And I'd say 9 other times it failed.
Right.
It just, the timing was just right. And all the stuff lined up. And we, you know, just happened to fall into that. And so that happened.
So now your new film, American Underdog, which, by the way, I absolutely love. My wife and I, we got the screener sent to us, man. My wife doesn't know about football much. But I'm like, look, it's a good movie. Look, it's got this guy in it, and it's got Anna Paquin. She's like, oh, Sookie. I'm like, yeah, Sookie from True Love. Yeah. True Blood. Yeah, so she's like, all right, I'll watch it. Yeah. And we're there on like a Saturday afternoon, and we just start watching it, and we're just like, son of a bitch, this thing's grabbing us. Holy shit. It's pulling me in. Like, what the hell? Like, I knew who Kurt Warner was. So I didn't know the extent of his story. I knew he was an underdog, but I didn't know the details.
Right.
But the key was watching my wife watch it, who knew nothing, and she was like getting involved in the emotion and the characters and the story. Right. The football was just an aftermath. Like, that doesn't even matter to her. It was all about the characters. And again, when you were saying IP, I mean, you've got Kurt Warner, who's a very famous football player, and then you throw the word underdog, and then you throw the word American underdog. I'm like, might as well just put up Stallone and Rocky up there at the same time, brother. I mean, like, you were hitting a bunch of good. So when I saw it come through my view first time, the trailer, I was like, oh, this is gonna do well. Oh, this is gonna do just fine. How did you guys get involved in this story, man?
Well, and it didn't hurt that the Rams won the Super Bowl and gave us some advertising for the home video. But it's again one of those things that fell to us. And I'm really grateful for it. But 20 years ago, when I was a sports cameraman, the only Super Bowl I ever worked was in 2001, Super Bowl in New Orleans, and it was Kurt Warner in his second Super Bowl against Tom Brady in his first. And you know, the story we tell in our movie had happened the year prior, and I just remember watching Kurt and being like just intrigued by the guy. There was just something very Rocky-esque. I mean, I think the films that influenced this one the most were Rocky, Cinderella Man, and Warrior, where it was really a lot of fighter stories about kind of one man against the world and fighting for something, that the stake that drove what happened in the arena. You know, and there's something very Rocky-esque about Kurt. But I just remember watching him go over to the stands and interact with this spiky-haired, beautiful lady. And that was his wife, Brenda. And I always said that I would love to know the story behind that. Never knew that I was going to be 20 years later that my brother and I would be the one to direct the film. Right. So when it came back around, I can only imagine it hit. We'd done another movie after that. And then as we were finishing, you know, the touches on the script for the story we were going to make, somebody said, you ought to talk to the Warners. Again, it's a film that's stuck in development at another studio. We specialize at that. And they said, but the option is up and you might want to look at it. So we went to their house in Phoenix and said, you know, we're not here to pitch you what your story is. What do you think your story is? And Kurt said, it's about the things off the field that drove what happened on it. Everybody knows the football, but I want them to know what I saw in my wife, Brenda, and my son, Zach, who's disabled and blind. And we're like, well, we can do that story. We know how to do that story. So when we stepped into it, and then the pandemic hit and threw all of our plans in the air, and then we finally, as we were writing the script, Zach Levi is a longtime friend from Shazam and you know, and Chuck and all that. And Zach and I were talking on FaceTime one day, and we had the same agent. And he said, what's this Kurt Warner movie I keep hearing my name thrown around in? I said, well, Zach, your book for the next 3 years, I wasn't going to pitch you. And he said, no, let me read the script. And I sent him the script, and he texted back at midnight that night and said, let's make a football movie. And then I called up the producer team, and I said, well, I just landed Zach Levi. I didn't really mean to, but he's in. And they're like, great. And so then it kept pushing because of COVID. And finally, we just like, if we push one more time, we lose Zach. He's going to do Shazam too. And so we just called him and said, hey, guys, what's your screw it number that we have to hit? And they gave us the number we had to hit to make the movie. And we said, okay, we've got to chop this schedule from 45 days down to 30 to make it. And so it was the most stressful thing I've ever done in my life. But we kind of, all that turmoil, we focused it on, we're like, this is the story we're telling, is this guy had the deck stacked against him. And we're all going to live Kurt Warner's story together in the middle of trying to film in a pandemic, you know. And that, once he was on board, he rallied around that. And then Dennis Quaid, he looked so much like Vermeil. I sent it to Quaid, and I said, Quaid, I'll let you play anybody you want, but I think it's special when an icon plays an icon. And I had done a highlight reel of Dick Vermeil, and I sent it to him. He's like, I'm your Vermeil. I'm going to do it. And then, you know, and then all these great character actors came on board, like Bruce McGill and, you know, Adam Baldwin and Chance Kelly and all these guys. And then the what tended over the top was, we're like, it has to be about, it's a co-starring thing. It's not, Brenda is very much the equal lead of this story. She's the underdog on the other side of the coin. And when Anna Paquin read the script, she fell in love with her. And she called me and she said, you know, I've never done anything interacting with really anything inspirational. I don't know anything about sports. I don't really know anything about faith. She's like, is that a problem for me playing the wife of a prominent sports star that's a Christian? And I said, absolutely not, Anna, as long as you can really try to fight to understand the person you're playing and make what is important to her important to you. And she's like, that's exactly how I work. I'm like, well, who wouldn't want to work with an Oscar winner? And once she signed on, it dramatically took off. And she and Zach paired so well together because Zach typically does the action comedy thing, mm-hmm. and he does it well, better than anybody. But Anna really grounded him really well with her drama. And then Anna typically goes for the hard, gritty characters and the chew on glass kind of artist kind of things. But Zach really kind of pulled her, you know, lifted her out and showed this lovable side that people haven't seen of her before. And so it made an incredible, and just, we just like, this is our moment. We have to do it now. If we don't do it now, it's never going to happen. We just rallied around that. And again, it could have been a failure, but it worked. So,
and both of them played parts that they generally don't play. I mean, you know, you never
seen exactly.
Zach. Yeah, Zach. No, I've never seen Zach in a dramatic role. He they both killed it. They both, I think that he was Kurt. I mean, there was just no question about it. And then when you see it, obviously, when you see the images of Kurt in the credits and stuff like that, which is just like, oh, man, it's just it just hit it, it that I wasn't prepared for it.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Let's just put it that way. I think it catches you off. It catches you off guard, you know. And I'm a pretty look, man. I've been a filmmaker for 30 years. It's hard to catch me. It's hard to catch me. So it's when a movie does get me, I was like, oh, son of a, I didn't see that coming. Like I generally could see things coming. I didn't see that coming. So you have, and it happened with me on I can only imagine because I didn't see it coming. So the way you guys are approaching stories is it has a very unique perspective. And yeah, you come in through faith and that angle of it, but it's hits you at an emotional level that generally you don't expect as a film, as an audience member, because so much of the stuff that we consume today, so McDonald's, fast food kind of entertainment. Yeah. And then when a home cooked meal shows up, you're not kind of ready for it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're used to McDonald's, when there's broccoli on your plate, you kind of roll your eyes at first, even though that's really what your body needs. And so it's like, how do we dress that up in a way that makes it non-threatening, but then still allow something of substance? And I think that, and I love hearing you say that, because I think the audience that I value the most out of any audience, I mean, absolutely, we serve a Christian audience that loves stories of faith, and I don't apologize for that. But the audience that I value their opinion the most is the audience that we call the benevolent skeptic. Mm-hmm. You know, the benevolent skeptic doesn't have anything against faith. It's nothing that they feel negative towards it, but it's also not something they naturally consume. And when you can kind of catch them off guard and earn the right to be heard and leave them with something to chew on and to think that they didn't expect, you know, it leaves them with something that maybe not a part of their natural daily diet. And I think it's really cool when somebody from that audience, you know, we did another film last year at the same time, which I don't know why we did that. We were just a glutton for punishment, but we did a documentary called the Jesus Music, which was about the history of Christian music. Mm-hmm. It was one that was just a passion project. There was a love letter to a lot of our friends. And there was a critic that I've since become really good friends with on through Instagram, but I didn't know him at this point. But he wrote his critique of the film, and he said I'm a self-professed you know agnostic, borderline atheist, and he said this is not my normal thing, but I expected one thing, and I came in realized, you know, and I feel like somehow the Irwins tricked me and changed some of the neural pathways to my brain. And he said, I'm kind of pissed about it. And you know, it's like that doggone it, you let me in. And I think that's sacred ground, because I'm not there to try to force feed anything to anybody. Well, I'm not there to try to create controversy. I'm just there to plant a seed of hope that I think people desperately crave right now.
Right. And American Underdog is not preachy at all.
No, it is so subtle.
It is such a subtle message, but the message in there that rings the most to me is the story of the underdog, which everyone can feel. The story of hope, the story of love, the story of a family. Those are the things that ring the most out of that movie to me, and everyone can really connect with that. And then, of course, you throw in American football, then you're ready to rock and roll. I mean, it's good to know.
Well, and it was really cool, because in that universal overlay, and I think the filmmaker that influenced us the most in our career that we kind of aspire to is Frank Capra.
Frank Capra, just that
old school, you know, Sicilian optimistic immigrant kind of perspective in that World War II generation that blatantly peddled hope. And people a lot of times didn't know how to take it at first, you know, It's a Wonderful Life didn't find its audience until years after the release. But he was just so good at it. And that's something I think in cinema we've lost, that for whatever reason, the backlash that we've got kind of the anti-hero. There's nothing wrong with the anti-hero. You know, I love, you know, The Godfather is one of my top 10 films that I love, but there's become so much of that. It's become so saturated in this fatalistic kind of perspective that I think as a industry, we've forgotten how to hope.
Yeah.
And so for us, I think the thing that we peddle without apologizing is a rush of hope. And it's a feeling that people don't know that they need, but then when they experience it, they walk away, they're like, I can't help but smile and believe in something better. And, you know, for me, a lot of that hope comes from stories of faith, but there's something universally relatable, even, you know, on top of that, that I think is something for everyone, regardless of where they come from. That's what we want.
Now, I'm going to ask you a couple questions, ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
You know, I think your individuality, your uniqueness mm-hmm. is your brand. You know, I think a lot of times people come in saying, I want to be like, you know, one size fits all and do this, and I just want to be vanilla and kind of find it, I'll do anything. But I think it's your uniqueness that will make you stick out. I think that uniqueness will also present the biggest obstacles up front, because people will want to put you in a box and say, well, you need to fit over here. You need to fit over there. And you're like, I don't know, I'm neither. And continue to lean into your uniqueness and find stories that display that at full volume, and allow there to be time for other people of like-minded taste to kind of center around your brand. And that will be, you know, where you find your breakout. Like, for years, David O. Russell struggled with finding out, like, what's my brand? And he would have all that frustration until he really leaned into the idea of, my brand is a dysfunctional family. That's what I know. And so then he does stories like The Fighter and Silver Linings Playbook and Joy. And those are all about dysfunctional families in their most charming sense of the word. And that's where his brand really popped out. So I just think, for me, my brand was about hope and about faith. And that's what we leaned into and didn't refuse to be categorized in one side or the other. And then eventually the brand comes out of that. So that's what I would say. My biggest advice is embrace your individuality.
And last question, three of your favorite films of all time.
Ooh, man, that's a tough one. I love Casablanca is probably my number one. I think particularly because they hadn't written the end of the movie when they started filming it.
Yeah, I know.
And they just discovered it along the way. Right. And it's perfect. It's so perfect. I would say that, you know, in It's Wonderful Life is number two. I love Frank Capra. And then I would say I love a movie that really caught me off guard when I watched it was Ron Howard's Cinderella Man. I absolutely adored that movie. That one was so good. Warrior would be number four, and then number 6 through 10 would be Spielberg films.
Just all of them. Just list them off. List them off. And where can people see American Underdog?
Yeah, it's out everywhere now, digitally, on Blu-ray, everywhere, wherever things are sold. And it's doing really well on iTunes. It's number three on iTunes right now. So check it out.
Brother Andy, I appreciate you coming on the show, man. Congrats on all your success and continued success to you, my friend.
Thoroughly enjoyed the interview, my friend. Let's do it again soon.
I want to thank Andy so much for coming on the show and dropping his inspirational knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Andy. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch his new film, American Underdog, which I highly, highly recommend, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/190. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. And on a side note, guys, I just want to thank you all for listening and sharing this information that we have at Bulletproof Screenwriting, because it has become one of, if not the biggest, screenwriting podcast on Apple and Spotify. I've been seeing the numbers, and it is so humbling that the show has grown so much over the last couple of years. It has grown faster than I ever expected it to. So humbly, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for all the support. Please continue to share this information. I want to help as many screenwriters and filmmakers out there as humanly possible. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.